As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens. We might be a couple of days late from our usual time, but that's okay. It's the off season and things have a way of their own. I am Marc-Antoine Godin with Arpin Basu. And Arpin, I'm very excited because today we've got a great guest.
We do have a great guest. We're going to talk to Craig Button later about the NHL draft, something that we like to do before the draft. We haven't done it for a couple of years, but he's always great with his insights. I love that his lists are always kind of unique to him and really based on his own thoughts and not a lot of group things. So we're going to have a great chat with him coming up. But before that, it's not Wednesday. It's not the day we normally put out the podcast, but news dictates sometimes that we have to put a podcast out on a different day. And the trade of Shea Weber on Thursday evening by the Montreal Canadiens is significant news. Frankly, something I did not think the Canadiens would be able to do. They did it. It's remarkable. They didn't retain any money. They didn't have to send out a draft pick. They actually got a useful player in return that they can actually play. What was your degree of shock when the news came out just before dinner time on Thursday?
Quite high. Yeah. Quite high. Yeah, because I think that the fact that there's 4 years left on his deal scared a lot of teams that could have been in a position to incorporate an LTIR contract on under the salary cap or either include it on their regular salary cap or stash it in LTIR and make good use of it. But 4 years is a long time because even the teams that have a lot of flexibility, they can shop it around and manage it. They have the higher ground in today's hockey, in today's NHL, because if cap flexibility is a valuable currency. So I think that the Canadiens were a little bit behind the eight ball, but it was, I might have forgotten about the Vegas Golden Knights, who were a team that were actually in need of a player like this. And when you're not in a position where you look to ship an LTIR contract to another team and say, okay, we'll take it for you, but it's going to cost you. In this case, the Vegas Golden Knights were willing to pay. At first I thought, okay, wait, Dadonov might be a little bit of a negative value player, but when you look at it closely, after 2 years where he was really slowing down, he had a little bit of a revival last season in Vegas, and there's actually something that can be done with this player. And even though there's only 1 year left on his deal, at worst, I mean, the Canadiens could try to create some value, help him having a good season, and swing him somewhere else at the trade deadline and get another asset for him. So all in all, I think it's great for the Canadiens. I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, yeah, flipping him at the deadline is a possibility. But been a really, even with the dip, like pretty consistent. Like, you know, 28 goals, 25 goals in 69 games his last season in Florida. 13 goals in 55 games in Ottawa in 2020-21. And then 20 goals last season with Vegas, despite the whole fiasco of being traded to a team that that he had a no-trade provision with.
And what a game when he first came back to Vegas.
Yeah, that's it.
After the canceled trade.
Fantastic. So anyhow, but, you know, the greater cap implications for the Canadiens are really a significant development. In my mind, Ken Hughes has almost set the bar for winning the offseason. I mean, really, I did not think, other than trading Jeff Petrie, like when he answered the question, I actually was the one who asked it, but, you know, do you feel there's still a market for Shea Weber to be traded? And his answer was just yes.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's pretty confident. I don't know if he should be that confident, but it was confident. It was a one word answer. It was a yes or no question that he was asked.
Yeah.
So I can't blame him for giving him one word answer, but it was a firm yes. And here he is a month and a half later. And he did it. And it's quite remarkable that he managed, as you mentioned earlier, they were a team that seemingly had no leverage in this situation, and they managed to find the only team that had even less leverage than they did. And my understanding of it is that the market for Evgeny Dadonov was basically zero. Was no team was willing to take on that contract, regardless of what Vegas was going to offer as a sweetener. It just wasn't. There was no market for him. So they were more desperate than the Canadiens are, because they're all in right now. They have to win in the next 2 to 3 years, but really this season or next, before things start getting really difficult for them. They don't have a whole lot of prospects in their pipeline. They've traded away a bunch of draft picks. They managed to become a team that was giving up leverage in any trade for Shea Weber, which is remarkable. It's really quite stunning. So bravo to Ken Hughes. You know, this doesn't mean the Canadiens aren't going to be operating in LTIR, just so that's clear. Carey Price's situation still looms over the organization. The trade doesn't really change a whole lot for the Canadiens as it comes to this offseason or even this upcoming season. And it's possible that if Carey Price gives it a go and then finds he can't play, that he winds up in the same situation Shea Weber was in, and the Canadiens have to go through all this again. But having both Shea Weber and Carey Price in this situation would have been a logistical and just a planning and a practical nightmare for the Canadiens. And so avoiding that eventuality or potential eventuality was a really important move to make. So the Canadiens should be very thankful that the Vegas Golden Knights are out there.
I might be getting ahead of myself here, but you know, there seems to be a good chance that Carey Price might hit LTIR at some point, because there's such a significant concern with the state of his knee. If he was to do it and end up on the LTIR and not being able to finish his contract, do you think he would be tradable in any way, the way that we just saw with Shea Weber yesterday?
Well, I mean, I would be tempted to say he's not, but I thought Shea Weber wasn't tradable. So, I mean, anything's possible, I guess. I mean, I think the situation here was pretty unique. It's not one that you see every day, but it is something that's actually happened already. I mean, the Tyler Johnson trade for Brent Seabrook's contract is very similar to the trade we just saw. Basically, what the Golden Knights have done is add the cap space that the $5 million of cap space that Dadonov had, which is what the Lightning did when they traded Tyler Johnson's cap hit, essentially, to Chicago to acquire Brent Seabrook, who was going on LTIR. Very similar situation. At $10.5 million, it's a bit tougher to do, I would think. But if anything, this has taught me is to not make assumptions. It's just
I'm thinking, you know, right now it's the Vegas Golden Knights. You mentioned how Tampa got Seabrook. Before that, back in the day, the Leafs went for Nathan Orton and David Clarkson. But there's going to be other teams, you know, that are competitive today. Let's say the Colorado Avalanche, who will have a ton of good, excellent players that will need, you know, top dollar, and it's going to be difficult for them to squeeze them under the cap. And there might be a chance to say, well, there might be an opportunity for a team that tries to figure out a way to get to keep their team together, that having a contract such as Carey Price as a way to buffer it could be a possibility. Now, today, it's the Vegas Golden Knights. They're battling against their window closing. But, you know, tomorrow it's going to be another team. As long as we see so little growth in the salary cap, in the salary cap, there's always going to be teams that are really looking for ways to, you know, get out of a logjam.
Yeah, absolutely. And Colorado is a good example of a team. I mean, it's a bit more tricky, I think, than people realize when it comes to adding a player who's heading for LTIR. There's a lot of math.
Because he's got to be included beforehand. You know, before you put him, he's got to be counted under the cap. So as of next season, under the $82.5 million, before you put him there afterwards replace it.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you could also put him on off-season LTIR. It's just that the whole thing being that operating in LTIR sucks. No team wants to do it. To do so intentionally is what's remarkable about the Golden Knights situation, is that they were so desperate to get Dadonov off the books and create cap space for this particular season that they were willfully agreeing to live in LTIR for 4 years. That's how valuable it was to them to be able to get this deal done for this season coming up. Is that the three seasons after that, where they're not paying Shea Weber a lot of money, he's going to make $1 million a year in each of those years, they're going to have to live in LTIR and all the limitations that come with it, all the inconveniences. It makes their financial situation far less flexible. A situation, again, to be clear, the Canadiens might find themselves in a matter of months. I mean, literally, if Carey Price goes to training camp and can't get through training camp, he might start the season on LTIR and the Canadiens will be living this reality. But they had no choice in the matter. The Vegas Golden Knights, that's what's remarkable here, is they're willingly doing that because that's their level of desperation for making this season work with Jack Eichel and Mark Stone and all the other high-paid players that they have. To get them all under the cap and make a legitimate, for their sake, hopefully healthy run at a Stanley Cup while this window's open, that's frankly closing pretty quickly for them.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see what's going to be the impact. I mean, yesterday, Kent Hughes mentioned that he did not know. He said to be determined when asked if how that trade could impact either moves he could make at the draft or in free agency. But it seems pretty clear that by adding Dadonov's contract, the window to get better this season for the upcoming season and just make sure that everybody fits under the cap, you know, with Romanov, with Rem Pitlick, who don't have a contract. I could add Samuel Montembeau. There's going to be a lot of financial gymnastics to come.
Don't forget, they're probably going to be adding the contract of whoever they pick first overall with all the bonuses that come with it.
That's a good point.
So there is money to be added, and those bonuses, if Carey Price ever finds himself on LTIR, those bonuses are going to come off their cap next year, and the bonuses of Caulfield and whoever. So it's not as if the Canadiens are out of the woods, is all I'm saying. But the fact that they were able to, they found a roadmap out of the woods by trading Shea Weber, basically. This is yeah. Now they've created a path for themselves to get to some sort of financial sanity.
Yeah. On that note, you mentioned the draft pick. We've got our guest today, Craig Button of TSN, who's going to enlighten us, I'm sure, about his perspective on the upcoming draft. Obviously, who sits at the top? He's been an advocate for Shane Wright for a long time, but there's a lot of good stuff coming in this interview. So right after the break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So our guest today on the Athletic Support is our friend Craig Button that we had before on this podcast 2 years ago. And he's back today to discuss the upcoming draft with us. So, Craig, welcome to the pod. It's nice to have you.
Oh, well, it's always a pleasure to join you and Arpon. I mean, your detail of work with the Montreal Canadiens in all areas of it is fantastic. It is. I'm not just saying that. So to be able to join you as we go into a off season with a lot of intrigue and a lot of excitement for Montreal Canadiens fans, you know, glad to join both of you here.
Well, thank you, Craig. You didn't have to say that, but we appreciate it nonetheless. It's always nice.
It was
to
in
hear.
The script, Arpon. It was in the script you sent me.
That's right. I forgot about that. But you know, I mean, that's, you know, the payment will come later. But for now, we're gonna. Well, actually, you know what? We just finished talking about it ourselves. So I think very quickly, because the really topical thing right now is the fact that Shea Weber just got traded. And we just wanted to just your quick reaction to that. And then we'll get into the draft. But we just finished talking about it. What was your impression when you saw that trade come across your screen yesterday?
I looked at it in two ways. You know what Shea has meant to the Montreal Canadiens from a leadership position. And you know, his presence that he has. And the players, you know, this past season talked about, you know, when he came back for a couple of times and just his ability to come in and, you know, how he carries himself, right? Well, it's really hard for other players, you know, to really take on that role of leadership while the presence of Shea Weber is there. So the first thing I'm going to say is, you know, this allows the Montreal Canadiens, Marty St. Louis and Kent Hughes now, to look at the next group of players that can be part of the leadership. You know, the looming presence and the great presence of Shea Weber now allows them to move forward in that respect. And I think that that's positive as you move forward because, you know, it's not about the past anymore. It's about the present and the future. And I think that that's significant going forward. Number two is, you know, Kent Hughes has talked about, you know, trying to build, you know, what the plan is long-term. And part of the long-term plan is, you know, not only helping your team be successful, you know, more successful in the coming year, but also being able to clear up some cap obligations, right? You know, yes, you can look at the $7.8 million and say, okay, we can use this in long-term injury reserve. But if you can get your balance sheet cap-wise in order, I think that that's another aspect that Kent Hughes really wants to focus in on. So it accomplishes that. Even though the dollars paid out aren't significant, it's something now that can help them in the short term with Danoff coming in, a little bit of scoring, gives them a little bit better chance next year to, like I said, improve their team, but also You know, it also gives that next group of players with the Montreal Canadiens an opportunity to assume, you know, a leadership positions. And it's not just the captain. It's in other areas where, you know, hey, who's gonna do that, you know, confidently and assertively.
It's been our argument, Arpin and I, that the Carey Price health situation, for which there's nothing Aki Hops can do anything about right now, it's almost handcuffing the Canadians in their ability to improve next season. And clearly we see it with the Shea Weber trade. There are moves that are being made in order to gain cap flexibility in the medium term, but next year could very well suffer from it. So my question to you would be, the Canadians can't say that they're tanking, right? This is not the message that they want to send. But at the same time, how do you go about things and wanting to be as competitive as possible when you know that next year, not only is there Connor Bedard at the draft, but there's Matvei Mishkov, there's Adam Fantilli, Charlie Strammel. It's going to be a top-heavy draft, right? And a high pick could go a long way in helping the Canadians build Kent Hughes often talk about the sustainable success that they're after. So how do you walk that line if you're the Montreal Canadiens?
Well, what I would say to you, Marc-Antoine, is that when you're looking at your team, and I think you just used the term, being as competitive as possible, they're not going for the Stanley Cup next season. But like you're trying to be as competitive as possible, because the one thing you don't want to have become part of your organization is constant losing. That kills spirit. That kills spirit. And that's not good for young players. And if you have, it's not good for any player, but it's certainly not good for young players. I think you have to be realistic about saying, hey, this is where we find ourselves right now. And, you know, but we're going to try to be a team that can be as good as we can, given our goals in the future, sustainable success. And this is where we're at right now, you know, in terms of trying to be competitive. Think back to when Marty came in to coach the team. I mean, it was a necessary move. And once we saw Marty get in there, you could see the spirit of the team, because they knew they had a better chance. And that's what you want to give them. It doesn't, like, they still finish as the worst team in the league, but the spirit changed. And when your spirit is dampened and it's not there, that's a problem. I think the balancing act here is keeping that spirit high and understanding that the opportunity to build your team, as you put, for sustainable success, Kent Hughes's term, is that, you know, we don't want to miss on these opportunities. And the 2022 draft, the 2023 draft are real significant opportunities for sustainable success. Let's go back quickly to the Tampa Bay Lightning. 2004, they won the Stanley Cup, lockout, right? Then they fell off. But it also led them in back-to-back drafts, Stamkos and Hedman. Mm-hmm. And here they are. We talk about sustainable success. It's a pretty good example, right?
Yes, absolutely. And they haven't picked, you know, they haven't picked number one overall since 1980, but the last time they picked in the top 10 in consecutive years was 1980 and 1981. So it's been a long time. And so that's something that I think the Canadians would benefit from. But let's shift gears to this draft coming up, because, as I mentioned, first time they're picking number one overall since 1980. It's not a clear cut. I know it's clear cut in your mind, Craig, but I mean, it's not as clear cut a decision for the Canadians as maybe Canadians fans would have hoped. You know, I think your views on Shane Wright are pretty well known, but still, I think there'd be some benefit to why do you feel so strongly about Shane Wright when there does seem to be a certain level of doubt that has crept in about how much better he might be than a Logan Cooley or even a Juraj Slafkovský.
So the first thing I would say to you, Arpon, is that, number one, like, you know, just because I'm clear in where I sit doesn't mean that I don't recognize that it's a lot closer. I do recognize that. And I do recognize that there's other players. And the examination through that process is understanding that it's close. You know, this is not a Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews. And even I go back to Austin Matthews, Patrick Laine, you know, going to the World Championships, or maybe Patrick Laine is the best player. So like even when we look back to that draft, I mean, Connor McDavid stands out, right? You know, the MacKinnon draft, you know, that wasn't clear cut. So, you know, making that decision, and I recognize that. What I would say about Shane, and I'm going to go back to my experience, is that in 1995 with the Dallas Stars, we drafted Jerome Iginla at 11. And I can tell you both this. Constantly after the draft, we got asked, what did you see in Jerome Iginla? What did you see in Jerome Iginla? What did you see in Jerome Iginla? We traded him for Joe Nieuwendyk. That year at the World Junior Tournament, where Jerome ended up being the most valuable player, you know, we had made the trade for Nieuwendyk. Other teams were in on it. There was teams that thought like they made better offers because they didn't think Jerome was very good. And here's why I go back to that. I think that Shane is very similar. If you're going to the game to have him go end to end, to show you this flash and dash, to pull you out of your seat, Jerome never did that. And Shane Wright doesn't do that. And I think that that becomes a factor, with respect to Shane. Tell me how many highlight reel videos you see of Patrice Bergeron. You don't see them. And I don't know how you measure mental effort. All I know is that Patrice Bergeron is always in the right place at the right time. And as I've gone through it with Shane Wright, there's two things that I could continue to ask. And I say type of player. I think he's the type of player. If he comes anywhere near close to Patrice Bergeron, we're talking. But here's the two things I ask. Who doesn't want Patrice Bergeron? And secondly to that, the part two, who doesn't want a Hall of Fame center? Everybody raise their hand and tell me who says no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell me.
I agree. Listen, I went through the exercise on Shane Wright and his mental capacity to like process information is really, really impressive. And you know, the number of times that he just one touch passes into space where teammates are arriving. I mean, it's really, but I think you kind of hit it there is that, first of all, this whole notion that every year there's a Connor McDavid or there's an Austin Matthews is just garbage, right? Like, it just doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. There are most years, those players aren't there. But secondly, there is this notion among scouts, and I've heard it. I've heard all sorts of comments about it being like, well, I would have liked to have seen more out of him on this given night, or I'd like to see him impose himself on the game and show a level of compete that maybe I'm not seeing. And I think it comes partially from what you're saying. What you don't see the highlight reel from him. You don't see the eye-popping kind of skills and plays from him. Why do scouts think like that? Like, I don't know in your experience, but it just seems to me like a player who has a certain steadiness to him and plays within a system willingly would be a value, but it seems to be a knock against him. Like, how do you view that?
Oh, I'm going to go quickly to three places. So the first place I'm going to go to, you know, is Les Jackson, who I worked with for a long time in Dallas. He's now with the Florida Panthers, you know, just terrific in terms of assessment. We were working together in Dallas, and it might have been, we were still in Minnesota, but we had a meeting, and you know, we had our scouts, you know, crossover, our local scouts were, regional scouts were, here's the guys you need to watch. So we're at our meeting, and we had this comment keep coming up. Well, he didn't play good for me. He didn't play good for me. He didn't play good for me. Finally, Les turned to the scout and he said, you know what? I have a suggestion for you next time. Next time you're going, we send you out to watch players, phone the player and tell him you're going to be there. Maybe he'll play good for you. You know what? Like, where do scouts think, you know, I'll be straightforward with you. I told, like, you know, Bob McKenzie in his midseason ranking, you know, he made the comment that the scouts have effectively put Shane Wright on notice. I phoned Kurt Overhart and I said, did they send that notice by email? Did they send it to text? Did they do it on social media? Like, seriously, like, really?
They had a sign up against the glass.
Yeah, you're on Kingston. Notice.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So the second place I go, in November of 2019, I was at a game in Shawinigan. And Rimouski was playing there. And the building was filled with scouts. Alexis Lafreniere was playing. Now, I marked the game. Everybody marks it in different ways. And it was a 2-1 game. Shawinigan won, Rimouski lost. And after the game, I'd marked it, but after the game, everybody's, wow, geez, and Alexis Lafreniere, he didn't do very much. Oh my God, what a disappointing night. I'm kind of going, the way I'd marked it, I thought he either had or created 18 grade A scoring chances. So now I'm hearing this after the game and I'm going, okay. Like, so I go back the next day, next morning, and I watched the video. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. It was only 17. I was off by that. So again, are we looking at results? Are we looking at, you know, like the expectation, right? So that's number two. And I just give you a recent example. So you're questioning mm-hmm. yourself. Like, you know, you're watching and you're trying to understand. All I know is this, is that when you're assessing players and you assess players from all over the world at different levels, right? To me, what's going to allow them to be good players in the NHL? What translates? Thinking, skating, playmate, all those different things, right? So I've always tried to stay away from good game, good week, good month, bad month. Players go through stretches where they're not as good as we want them to be, but that's why it's over a continuum. And so, like, you understand and you hear it, and I, you know, I've heard it with lots of players. Oh, he didn't do very much tonight. He didn't do this, or I was expecting more. Okay, that's fine. But that's why it's you're evaluating over time, not just in one part aspects. And you look and you watch, and what translates to the NHL. The other thing that I always say, keep in mind, they're going to be playing with better players. So are they doing the things where better players can take advantage, and then now they're going to be more productive? I think that's the case with Slafkovský. Like, he didn't play with real top-end players in TPS. So, you know, so his productivity might not be as good. But when I watch him make plays and I watch the things that he does, when he gets with better players, I think that you'll see more productivity from his game. And I think that potential projection, translating, those are really key aspects. And when you talked about how he processes and being in the right place, I see that with Shane. And I question myself too. It's not like I sit here and bang, it's clear. Like, you question yourself, and that's part of the examination.
You mentioned expectations. Of course, when it comes to Shane Wright, there's the whole discussion about his exceptional status at 15 years old. He was phenomenal back then. And now this past season is a bit more like coming back to earth and reducing the expectations a little bit. But I wonder, to which extent is there any room or any possibility that we might see in his growth and in the extent of his potential shades of the player that we thought he was when he was 15 years old? Or is that book closed and from now on it's more through the lens of his 17-year-old season that we should look at him?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you look at it just in one place or just another place, Marc-Antoine, but you got to consider this is where he was. This is where he's progressed to, right? Like, we drafted Jerome Iginla 11th overall. We thought Jerome was going to be a really good player, a power forward, 35 goal scorer. That's what we thought. We were wrong. He was a superstar, right? 600 goal scorer, right? Like, so, right. But we projected him as a really good player, right? And he was better than we thought. There's other players that you project to be better that don't turn out to be as good. So I think as you watch over that period of time, one of the things that I go back to, and I remember when I first saw Shane play at 14 at the Silver Stick, you know, somebody said, you got to go watch this Shane Wright kid. Okay, you know, you listen, you pay attention, you go. And right away, people kept saying, he's like a lowercase Sidney Crosby. And I'm going, whoa. I said, he's not Sidney Crosby. I watched Sidney at 14. This is not. So when you start taking a player and start saying he's this or that, and it's not realistic, well, that creates expectations that aren't realistic. And I know that at times I just kept saying, like, he's more of a two-way center. I became more confident in comparing him to Patrice Bergeron over time. But if you're going to compare a player at that age to Sidney Crosby, guess what? It's never going to be realistic expectations, and everybody's going to be disappointed. So in finishing in my answer, you better look over time what a player is and what you realistically think he can become. We all look at the, you know, I just went through a call this morning about ceilings. Okay, well, a lot of times it's easy to talk about ceilings, right? How many players reach their ceilings? We're always projecting the best. We want to see the best in a player. But a lot of players, for different reasons, don't reach that ceiling. Sometimes they're not good enough. Sometimes it's not their fault that they weren't evaluated properly. You know, that you put that on them, and go back and look at the first round over years. And it doesn't matter, top five, top 10, first round. There's 10, 12 players that never, ever are able to come anywhere close to what teams thought they were going to be.
Right. And that's one more thing on this, and then we're going to kind of move on. But listening to people talk about Shane Wright, watching him play, looking at the things that he does well, when the Canadiens acquired Nick Suzuki, they sent him back to Guelph, right? And so I watched a lot of Nick Suzuki at Guelph. And all of the things, some of the knocks that are on Shane Wright right now are the same knocks you heard on Nick Suzuki. Not always engaged, not always competitive, doesn't take over games, it's kind of slow, you know, these things. So my question is, and I'm gathering that you kind of agree with that comparison, but when you have two, I see Shane Wright becoming a player somewhat similar to Nick Suzuki. I don't think the puck skills are quite the same, but still, in terms of a thinker, he seems to think on the same level as Nick Suzuki. So when you already have a Nick Suzuki, would you not prefer to have some variety between your top two centers as a team building principle, I guess?
What I would say to you is I 100% agree with you about Nick Suzuki. There wasn't a lot of flash and dash to Nick Suzuki. There wasn't a lot of, you know, and you watch him. You know how good Nick Suzuki is. I mean, he's a really.
Well, he was playing 28 minutes a night in junior. Like, you got to manage.
You have to pace yourself. Exactly. There's no way you can. So, but you know what a good player he is. Mm-hmm. To your question about variety, yeah, variety would be nice. Variety is always nice. You know, having different. But at the same time, you know, you can't force variety into your decision making if variety isn't there.
Right.
If variety isn't there, you know, so when you start to look and you consider and the process, you know, the Montreal Canadiens will go, okay, what does this player mean for our team? What does this player mean for our team? You know, when we go back to the third overall pick in 2018, Kotkaniemi, center, big, strong center. Now, mm-hmm. I mean, everybody liked Kotkaniemi, and Kotkaniemi came in that first year. We all know where he's ended up. You talk about Nick Suzuki going back to junior. We can ask ourselves the question, it's the big what if. What happens if Kotkaniemi went back and, you know, developed more of an offensive game at his age group? You advance him two steps, not one, two steps when you're at 18 coming into the NHL. He hasn't even had a chance to be productive at lower levels and to build the confidence. You know, I'll go back to Patrice Bergeron, Eric Staal, and Jason Spezza. And they've all said the same thing over the years. When the lockout happened in 2004-05, they went back and played in the American Hockey League, and they were able to build on that confidence. We all know what good players they became. I'm not saying they wouldn't have become that, but we see the benefits of going back and managing it. So, you see a player that's ready, you use them. But is there variety there? Is there variety there? And I'm not going to guess here. I'm going to mention Logan Cooley as the centerman. So, you know, Logan Cooley's a really good centerman. And so you ask yourself, what does it mean to have Suzuki and Cooley? What does it mean to have Suzuki and Wright? And that's the process you go through. How does our team look? What else do we have? Who's our third line center? What kind of wingers do we have? You know, we all look at one player, but you got to consider what it means for your overall group. And, you know, one thing that Marty St. Louis, I mean, we know he's clear on. And I mean, he likes creative players. He likes players to use that creativity and their imagination. And, you know, Logan Cooley certainly fits that bill.
Mm. And he knows him. He's played with his son.
Yeah.
So in your rankings back in May, you had Slafkovský number four. So the debate at the top has been mainly in the public discourse between Wright and Slafkovský. But you had Slafkovský at number four. You had Joachim Kemmel at three. And Logan Cooley was number two. Do you see any scenario where Cooley could be taken number one?
Yeah, and I just want to just give you a little bit of a preview. Friday or Monday, I'll have my final list out. Slavkovsky is two now.
Okay.
Kemmel is still three, and Cooley now is four. But
wow,
I will say this just about Joachim Kemmel. I think he's a terrific talent. I've seen what he did in the SM Liga. He was the leading scorer in the SM Liga as a 17-year-old player before he got injured. And then, you know, some different challenges. I do. I think he's fantastic. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I think Cooley's fantastic. I think Slavkovsky, but they're all different. So that's just, you know, I have to at some point in time kind of go one, two, three, four, five, all the way through. So
yeah,
do I see a scenario? We're absolutely, I do, MA. I see Cooley a lot like Sebastian Aho. I'm going to ask the question. Wow. Why wouldn't you want Sebastian Aho? Wait a second. Didn't the Montreal Canadiens make an offer sheet on Sebastian Aho? I know it fits the script, and I'm not trying to fit him in, but I really do see Logan Cooley as a Sebastian Aho type player. Okay. Sebastian is an amazing player. And I think Logan, you know, the skill, the ability to play in so many different situations, power play, five on. Like I think that's a quality. And Arpon, it goes back to your variety.
Well, you know, yeah.
Logan might be more dynamic offensively than even Nick. It doesn't mean Nick's not somebody that's incredibly valuable, but he might be able to produce it at a higher offensive rate than even Shane Wright, perhaps.
He's also a left shot.
There's the right and a left shot. You get that balance. That's another part of the variety. Absolutely. So can I make a case for Logan Cooley? Absolutely, I can make a case for a scenario where they draft. And again, there's other picks. There's other players they have. You start to think of some of the wingers that the Montreal Canadiens have. Oh, they have that great goal scorer in Nick Suzuki, and they have Josh Anderson. You know, so a left shot center coming in and playing with those two right wingers, you know, where do you go from there, right? Like, you know, there's some pretty good, again, how you balance and what it means for the productivity of those players. All considerations to me that have merit for him going first.
So let me ask you this. As when you're in management and you're preparing for the draft, to what extent does the fear of missing on a guy who you think might be great, but you're not sure will be, but he could be, as opposed to the guy you're very confident will be very good. So the fear of missing that guy, that you passed on this guy who you knew in your heart had a chance to be a superstar and didn't take him, how much does that drive the discussion with scouts and in preparation for the draft, generally speaking?
Well, so what I will say, I think it's human nature to not want to be wrong. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And right. You know, how do you encourage, like, you know what, we're just going to focus in on going forward and trying to be right, as opposed to not wanting to be wrong. Two different things: trying to be right as opposed to not wanting to be wrong. Nobody wants to be wrong, and it plays into the part of the scouting. You know, having been in so many different discussions over the years, and you go, well, what if he turns out to be this? Well, what happens if he doesn't turn out to be that? It carries big weight, and again, and you know, the public discourse and discussion about why wouldn't they take this guy? I mean, there was an article that I saw a little while back about, and it was Chris Gear talking about it when he was an assistant general manager in Vancouver, when they were having a debate on Elias Pettersson and Cody Glass. They ended up on the right side of it, right? But you know, it's always look at how skinny Elias Pettersson is. I can't begin to tell you how many times, you know, as it gets closer to the draft, oh, geez, like, he's pretty slight. Yeah, he's only 17 or he's only 18, right? Like, you know, but these are the thoughts that come into the mind, right? And they do. So it does play a part in it. And I think, you know, I was talking to some people in New Jersey, and, you know, they moved up to number two in this draft. And we got talking a little bit, and I know they took Heischer number one in 2017. And that was a real jump ahead for Nico. He was really good. But I know they loved Cale Makar. I know they did. And so they had somebody on their staff that thought that Cale Makar could be close to Bobby Orr.
Right.
Okay. So think about somebody on a staff.
I hope that guy's been promoted at this point.
There's been some changes there.
Yeah. But they have a good group in New Jersey. Just stop and think. I mean, Ray Shiro was the general manager at the time. So just think about somebody saying, well, I think he could be maybe like a Bobby Orr. Well, all of a sudden, Bobby Orr, give me a break. Instead of saying, well, what happens if he comes close to Bobby Orr? Like, what happens if he's only 80% of Bobby Orr, right? But but again, now you're looking at it and going, 5'11", playing junior A hockey in Brooks, you know, and instead of just focusing in on what you think he can be and then embracing it, but there's so much that goes into, you know, the public perception, you know, what does it mean and everything. And that plays, that it absolutely plays. And it's part of human nature.
And the higher you pick, the more pressure there is not to be wrong.
So true. You know, I read an article too about Steph Curry. Steph Curry, I mean, think about what he's just done with the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah.
What was he, like the eighth pick or the seventh pick or something, like, you know?
Yeah. It was actually very similar to Makar because he went to Davidson. And so it was like, it's, you know, who's the number one overall pick out of Davidson? It makes no sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So absolutely. You know, and so what's obvious, right? Well, this player's obvious. Like, you know, let's go back to 1980. Doug Wickenheiser scored 81 goals. He was big, he was strong and everything. Denis Savard's sitting right in the Montreal Canadiens' backyard, right? Like, so we're going to pass on the big, strong centerman and Doug Wickenheiser. You know, they could have drafted Mike Bossy in 1977. Mark Napier was a good NHL player, full stop. But you'd think that in your own backyard, you would know better than anybody, right?
Right.
And the Montreal Canadiens missed on Denis Savard and Mike Bossy, or Mike Bossy first and Denis. So it happens, and it happens even in your own backyard.
But to me, Cooley is that guy in this draft, in my eyes. I'm not sure if what you think, but to me, I watch Cooley play, and you want someone who gets you out of your seat. Like, you want someone that makes you pop. Like, all the things that they say that Shane Wright doesn't do, this guy does those things every time, like every game almost, and is not a defensively irresponsible player. Like, he can play in his own end. He's not bad. And it's the vision's there. Everything's there. The only thing is that he's 5'10" and he's somewhat slight at 180. But to me, if you're really projecting and being like, okay, like, this guy hits that ceiling that you were talking about earlier, He's gonna be the best of them all. It seems to me that could be what's going on in draft rooms, and it's a tough call at number one, is to Marc Antoine's point, to make that leap of faith that he will hit his ceiling.
Well, and you're right. So as a manager and Kent Hughes running his first draft, you know, having never been in a draft room, like, you know, listening to the encouraging thoughts. We're trying to maximize the pick, and maximizing the pick is not about worrying about not being wrong. It's about how can we maximize and be right.
Yes.
And I think that becomes a real significant opportunity for Kent Hughes to instill that in his scouting group. But when you talk about, but then the other part of this is how you're building your team. So we have Nick Suzuki and Logan Cooley. What does it mean? And, you know, you don't build your team with one player, but you build them with one player at a time in different spots to fit it all in. And it's not just done with the first overall pick. It's done with picks throughout different parts of the draft. And, you know, that's the Edmonton Oilers had those four first overall picks in a 6-year span. They were still terrible.
Yeah. Because they couldn't draft after that.
Exactly. So it's not just about the first overall pick. It's important, but you have to build it out too. And I think that, you know, it's team building and what goes with it. And like, Logan's a really, really talented player. And you know, there might be but I think Kemmel has some of those qualities that are elite, like David Pastrnak elite.
Wow. Okay.
That's just my comparable type player.
Right. Okay.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? we've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Well, that's actually a good segue to kind of talking about later in the first round. The Canadians don't only have the number one overall pick. They're picking at 26. They're picking at 33. They're picking at 62. So they've got, and they got three picks in the third round. So they have a lot of ammunition. There's a lot of ability. In your eyes, that ammunition would, in theory, allow the Canadians to maybe move up and go get someone, maybe somewhere in the late teens, early 20s kind of range. In that range of the draft, let's say from like 20 to 32 or so, what are some candidates of guys you think that might slip, that might be available for a trade up, that could be a difference maker in this draft?
So, you know, a couple of things I'll say before I get into the specific players, and I know what you're both going to say. How many times have you heard in a draft where a team goes, "We had that player rated a lot higher"?
Every single year.
Can't believe he was still available.
Marc-Antoine, that is, yeah, can't believe he was there. And the reason that is because teams rate players differently. So what I would say is 20 to 30, where Montreal has those two picks, right? They're gonna pick somebody that's in their top 15 players. They are. Right. Their list will have those two picks will come, if they use those two picks, will come from players that they have rated in their top 15. That's just the way it works. You know, we go through lists and we put their, but you know, it's not like they go, "Oh, okay, at 26, you know, we're going to get the 26th player on our list." They're going to get somebody that they have rated 15 and 30 or 26 and 33 they have, excuse me. Yeah. So they're going to pick, right? So at 33, they're going to get somebody in their top 15. They are. Right. So,
but if that's the case, why do teams trade up then?
Well, because why they trade up is because they're looking at 30th pick in the draft and they're looking at the 12th guy on their list still there. And they're going, "We need to get that guy."
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's why, you know, because you've rated players higher on your list and you want them. And I've always said this, nothing wrong with going after players you really want. There's nothing wrong with that. But the reason is, Marc-Antoine, is because you've rated, you're looking at your list and going, "Oh my Lord, we got this. We got to move up to 22 because we have this guy at, we're picking 26. He might not be there." Right. And that's a big part of it, right? Everybody's going to evaluate it in a different way, but the players that they're looking at when they're looking to trade up, they don't think they're going to get them. So they want to move up because they rated them high.
Obviously, that was actually self-explanatory.
Yeah, I know, but like,
but it's but similar to, like, I would suggest that Campbell is a guy that's probably not going to go third, right? I mean, it's you.
I would agree
third,
with you. I would agree.
So
with
he's
you.
Probably so in your eyes, just kind of looking at the landscape and getting and your sense of what teams are thinking about guys. Is there a guy in your mind that would be in your top 10? Let's say that would be available at say 20. Like we've kind of targeted Washington and Pittsburgh as being two teams that could use more picks that would maybe be agreeable to moving back to 26 in exchange for an extra second round or whatever. Is there any guy that you think might last that long that would be worth the trouble?
So do I include the Russians in here? Because I think that there's a couple of Russians.
We're going to get into that, but you can include the Russians. It's up to you, but we're going to get into the Russian question in a bit. Yeah.
Well, okay, so there's a couple of uncertainties, right? Number one, with the whole situation in Russia, what does it mean for visas and everything? And, you know, we've seen what the CHL, they're not allowing players to be drafted from Russia or Belarus. And that's out of the NHL's hands. You know, this is a government initiative, and you may have. So does that hurt Danila Yurov, from being drafted higher than maybe we would expect him to be? You know, we've seen with Ivan Marashnichenko, it looks like the bill of health is there. Teams are really working through that aspect, which adds a different layer to him. But the Russian, but those two players specifically are really good players. Yeah. So, everybody knew Pavel Bure was a good player, but you didn't know if you were going to get him. That's why he went in the sixth round. Everybody knew Sergei Fedorov was a good player, but you didn't know. But you start to look at it and go, okay, who would we be considering that could be better than that? And I think that, I mentioned those two guys there. There's a couple of players that I think, come into play, a little bit deeper to where you're at. And I think he's a terrific player. I have him in my top 10 is Jimmy Snuggerud, big, strong winger. Again, we're going back to how you're building out who else you think you could get there. I think Jimmy is like one of the most improved players along with Cutter Gauthier from the National Team Development Program year over year. To me, big, strong, scoring, offensive winger, hearing different teams talk, listening, he's a player that's got a bigger range where he could go. So to your point, he's one of them. I really, really think, I just mentioned the two Russians. I think Yuri Kulich, who I've always liked, reminds me a lot of Patrick Eliash. Patrick Eliash was a terrific player for the New Jersey Devils for years. I mean, so good that he's right on the cut line, just below the cut line for Hall of Fame discussion. He's not a Hall of Famer in my view, but that's how good he was. And I think he's got that style of game. So those are two players that I think could fall into that range. I mean, we know but players that I think that I have rated higher that I think might come into that group, along with the two Russian players, Yurov and Marashnichenko.
Because the read with the Canadians, I think, with the new management is that, okay, we've got a tons of prospects, but those guys are not necessarily difference makers. So we have in our pipeline a lot of potential depth, a lot of guys that could become NHLers, but who is going to really move the needle, be an impact player? And in that sense, they might shift gears now, and instead of going for quantity of picks, more darts on the board, like Marc Bergevin and Trevor Timmons used to say. Now they could be in an optic where they say we're going to look to get guys that could be home run picks. And it might involve a little bit more risk, but in a team that's not necessarily very deep in terms of high-end talent, where who are those guys that we could take a swing at, higher-end talent that could still be available either at 26 or 33, or by packaging those picks, getting higher in the late teen range and scoop someone there. So I think that we could expect a change in philosophy, but it's tricky because you might want to take a swing at getting a higher end talent that has more risk involved with him. And at the same time, if you package two picks to trade up, so you've already used some ammunition turning two picks into one, and it's in order to get a guy that's got risk around him. It's a daring proposition. I mean, it's a little bit risky, but I think that at some point, something's got to get done. If you want to have top six forwards, really quality prospects, you have to swing with this risk that you might miss.
So I totally agree with you. And if you go up to the plate and you try to hit a home run, you're going to have to take a bigger swing. And it might not get you a home run, but you might get a triple, right? But if you go up to the plate and you're going to try to hit a single, you're not hitting a home run. So, you got to understand, what kind of swing you want to take. They're very different swings. And if you want difference makers, you're going to have to take a bigger swing. And you're right. There's players. We look at the draft and we look at the history of drafts. If you get a regular NHL player out of the first round, you're doing really well. Really well. Just a regular NHLer. Somebody that plays a lot, like that fits into your lineup, plays 600-700 games, you're doing really well because there's so many players that don't. But How do you get those difference makers? You know, we go back in time, Mark Andrew. I think back to Stéphane Richer. Stéphane Richer was an unbelievable junior player, the big shot. He was big, he was strong. And all the things you heard about Stéphane Richer, oh, yeah, he's lazy, he does this or that. Yeah, well, guess what? He had skills and attributes that very few players had. In the second round, they took Stéphane Richer, right? If you want Stéphane Richer, you want players that can be difference makers, you better step up to the plate ready to try to hit a home run, knowing that you might not. But if you want to hit singles, guess what? You're never going to hit a home run. And I think that's where I'm with you on that, Marc Antoine, at that point in the draft. And it kind of switches, doesn't it? We talk in the first part of the draft, the top end, scouts thinking about, I don't want to be wrong. Well, go for the home run in that part of the draft because that's where you can be really right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, but it's kind of an opposite mentality. I think people are willing to go for it at 17, 20, 23, whatever. They're more willing to make a mistake there or take the risk of being wrong than they are at number one, two, or three. But I think
– can I interject real quick?
Yeah, sure.
George McPhee told me years ago when he was with Washington, he said, I hated picking in the top 5-8. He goes, you like picking there, but he goes, you know how you rate your players, right? You're kind of falling into this is the group of players and you're risk averse. You're trying to, he goes, but as you pick later and they took Alexander, he told me the two players, Alexander Semin, I think at 13, and they took Kuznetsov in the 20s. And he said, those were players we rated really high. He said, but where we were picking, we could go for it. And, I just mentioned two Russians, not by accident, but George is a longtime GM, success and everything. I mean, he talked about being risk averse in that top part of the draft and where he liked to be able to be in a spot where he could say, I'm going for it here and let's go for it. He encourages group to do that.
The St. Louis Blues had a similar track record, with Tarasenko, Robert Thomas, in that range of players where they really did some good drafting in the late teens.
Yeah. And I think the one
absolutely
thing the Canadians, Jeff Gorton has shown a willingness to go up. I mean, Braden Schneider and Keandre Miller, he traded up for each of them to go get them. And now they're on the Rangers blue line. So, I mean, it does pay off, but I mean, the Russians in particular is, it seems to me like every year, this is not that different from how Russians have been viewed over the last few years, right? It's heightened because of the situation in Ukraine, obviously, and just the general geopolitical kind of climate. But this is something that always exists. Kucherov lasted into the second round largely because he was Russian, right? I mean, it's no one really knew about Romanov largely because he was Russian. So this year, it seems to me like every year, it seems like the Russian players represent a certain market inefficiency that you can go take advantage of. But this year, it seems to be even greater than that. This Yurov kid, actually both of them that you just mentioned, what excites you about them in particular?
I think that if Danila Yurov was had the opportunity to play more, had the opportunity to be seen more, I think you very well could be talking about him in the top 5-6 players, 7 players, perhaps. He's got a power to his game. He's got a skill to his game. You know, those types of players that can produce offensively, that can, lean on you, create a lot of different opportunities and advantages for your team, with that power and the skill combination. There's not a lot of those players. And I think that Yurov has that. You know, when I look at Marashnichenko, I call him a bulldog goal scorer. That doesn't mean he's just trying to drive, to the net. He can score in a lot of different ways, but he's got that hunger like a Philip Forsberg. Philip Forsberg, when he gets that puck, he's got that mentality that I want to score and I'm going to find a way to score. And I think Marashnichenko has that. Those aren't common qualities. There's not a lot of Philip Forsbergs out there. There's not a lot of these big, strong, two-way players with power and skill. We look at Slavkovsky, he's got power. He's got drive to his game and some good skills, no question about it. There's not a lot of those guys. There really isn't. So when you start to look at those two players specifically, I think scouts know how good they are. It's now a question of, are you going to take a step forward and say, we're going to take them. right? And, you know, we talked about the Russian factor, and I just use that term loosely, but there might be another benefit to drafting those players in the first round this year. They just stay over in Russia and they just develop. You don't have to rush them over. And I don't know what their contract status is. Just let them go and play. And just, you know, we don't know what geopolitically the world will look like in 2 months or 6 months or 18 months. So maybe just let them go. I know NHL teams want to get their hands on players to help them develop and everything, but they're still 18 years old. There's still lots of growth and development and maturity that needs to take place. Maybe like drafting Bure and Fedorov, just out of sight, out of mind, let them go play. When the opportunity comes, they come over. Kaprizov is
a perfect example. I mean, Kaprizov was drafted in the fifth round.
Great example.
Same kind of deal.
Yep.
But Yurov, I mean, he barely played, right? With Magnitogorsk, barely 3 minutes a game or something like that. Didn't register a point in 21 games, but he dominated the MHL.
Yeah.
When you have a league like the MHL, what sort of level of competition or how much stock would you put in dominating that league? Because you have another Russian prospect, Gleb Trikozov, who also put up huge numbers in the MHL. And, you know, he's knocking at the door of the first round, but he probably will be more a second round guy.
And I would also throw Perevalov in there too. Perevalov is another real good offensive player. But what it is, Marc-Antoine, is it's a really good junior league. In Russia, they never had a really good junior league, you know, and so they were losing a lot of players, you know, in terms of development. And the club teams, you know, they're looking, well, we need players and we're not developing them at the youth age. They come up, but they don't play. And then, you know, they've done a really good job in two areas. They've done it with the MHL and the VHL, you know, which would be like the American Hockey League. What it does is it allows players to stay. It's much what they did in Sweden. You know, Sweden had the same problem. They didn't have a viable junior league. So now the players that were too good for junior were never challenged and they weren't good enough to play in the SHL. That's what happened in Russia. So now is Yurov ready to play in Magnit? No. And that's why he only played 3 minutes, but he can still be in his age group, developing and playing and gaining that confidence, which is a good thing. So it's a good solid junior league. And it's something that I think is good for the players to keep playing and keep having success as they grow, because ultimately, whether they want to play in the KHL, like at 19 or 20 or whatever, before coming to the NHL, it's steps that I think help them progress naturally and at their own rate.
You mentioned, you referred to the Swedish Junior League. So the J20 National, this year you had a whole line who represented their national team with Jonathan Lekrimäki, Noah Oslund and Liam Ugrin. How do you separate their potential and where do you see them go?
Yeah, it's a great question because individually they're all really good. So here's what I would say. I think Noah is the center, Oslund, you know, he's got the most room for physical maturity. Like, you know, he's still, you know, we look at the Scandinavian and Nordic countries, they take a little bit longer to physically develop, right? And I think that that's the case with Noah. Really smart, really diligent and purposeful. You know, he might have some elements to his game like Michael Backlund. Michael Backlund was a first-round pick around 25, if I recall correctly. You know, and he's really turned into a really good, solid two-way, not big points, but enough points and a really good player. That's where I kind of see Noah. Jonathan Lekrimäki, I think, is a real talent and a player that can, you know, drive play through his playmaking and his thinking, but he's also, I think, a player that can score. I kind of probably see him more as a 25, 30 goal scorer with his potential and 40 assists. And it might be 20, 40, might be 25, 35, but a little bit more weighted to playmaking. But I see him as a player that can be a first line right winger. And Liam Ugrin, to me, is that just that strong left winger, drives to the net, scores in and around the net, creates chances below the goal line, along below the circles, I should say. You know, hard to handle one-on-one, but, you know, a player that can really impact the game, you know, through his skill, through his thinking, and a little bit, I would call lowercase power to his game, but somebody that's got real initiative to push through a lot of things. So when I say Backlund with Austlin, I mean, that's probably a second line center. I can see Ogren and Lakarimäki knocking on the door of first line wingers. I think they're that good. You know, Liam Ogren, I don't know if you're aware of it, but he played with a displaced fracture in his ankle during the U18 tournament. And yeah, he was probably at about 65%. And, we knew that and watch him and to watch him play. And I've been lucky because I saw him play healthy. You know, those players, at the very least, they're going to be, I think, really good second line players. Back to top six, Marc-Antoine. There you think they can be there, you know, it's great to talk about a ceiling of number one, but at the very least, they're really good top six wingers.
Last question for you, Craig, and thanks. You know, this has been great. But the one thing I find interesting this year about the Canadian situation is that 33 pick. I think every year, whoever picks first in the second round, you get this sort of auction going on. Like, you know, the first round ends pretty late at night. The second round starts relatively early in the day, the next day. Because I feel like with the variance this year, from team to team, list to list, and what you said earlier is that, at 26, you'll probably get someone in your top 15. Well, at 33, someone in your top 15, maybe even in your top 10 this year, might be there. You're talking about Snuggerud earlier, who's in your top 10. Well, he conceivably could be there at 33. I don't think it's likely, but it's possible. Just from a manager's perspective, when you're and I don't think you ever picked first overall as a manager, if I'm not mistaken.
I didn't.
So you never had that first pick on day two, but just in terms of...
You might have gone after one, though.
Yeah, that's the auction aspect of it. Like going home after the first round and just losing your mind because this player is available and the first pick of the next day, you could go get it. I mean, to what extent do you think this year the Canadians... Because I think every year that team fields calls after the first round is over. But do you think that'll be a heightened thing this year as opposed to maybe other years?
Yeah, I do. And it is every year. Because, again, it goes back to what we talked about earlier about teams drafting players that they couldn't believe were there.
Yes.
Have rated really high on their list. Right. So after the first round, and we see players that thought they were going to be drafted in the first round, maybe expect to be drafted in the first round, walk out of the building, you know, dejected because they haven't been dropped. But you look and go, they're going early in the second round. You know they're going early in the second round. So now you start to consider, although like so many teams now, everybody knows Montreal has the first pick in the second round, and so many other teams have players rated high. They have players rated high. They're going, oh my God. And they're picking 39 or they're picking 41 or whatever, you know, pick a number. And they're going, we need to think about the Arizona Coyotes. Think about the Arizona. They have three picks. No, they have four picks from 34 to 45. They have three in the first round and four. Yeah, I think they have four from 34 to is that correct?
I'm going to check it right now.
Yeah, I think
they have four in the second round. They have their own. They have the Islanders, they have the Flyers, and they have the Sharks. So yeah, that sounds about right.
So right in that range.
Yeah.
So now you're the Arizona Coyotes and you look at Montreal 33 and you have this player that let's just say it's Arpon Basu and they have Arpon rated third on their list.
Right. Sure.
right. And they want you. So now they're phoning Montreal and they go, well, we'll give you two of our second round picks. And now Montreal is going like, geez, we could get whatever I'll say 36 and 41 without knowing the exact thing. Montreal's going, well, now we get two picks. Right. That's where the interest comes, you know, and Montreal, Kent Hughes will be fielding a lot of calls. He'll be fielding a lot of calls after the first round that night. And again, the debate will go back with his group. What does this mean? Is there somebody that we want at 33? Because a lot of times the guy you think you're getting at 33, you might get a 36. And again, that becomes part. That's where Jeff Gorton, I think, is going to be really instrumental for the draft. Kent's never gone through this. You know, yeah. He hears different things from the scouts. Jeff can look through it and just say, hey, you know what? I've been through there. Be patient. I think that guy can be there. It's a good move. Here's why it's a good move. Or he also can hear the scouts saying, this is a guy we want. You know, back Mark Andrew, we think this guy can be a home run hitter. We don't want to take we don't want to be a double. We want to get a home run. So Jeff hearing that can differentiate and say, hey, this is something that's pretty significant. I'll give you an example. Toronto Maple Leafs, in the year they picked Mitch Marner four, they had the 24th pick. And they went through this exercise of trying to get more picks, more quantity. And yeah. Mark Hunter wanted Travis Konecny at 24. They went through this whole exercise of, wow, more picks, trading back and everything. They traded back. Mm-hmm. They didn't get Travis Konecny. And if you go back and look at the draft, they traded back twice. They traded with Columbus and then they traded back again. And they took Travis Dermott. You ask yourself,
yeah,
Travis Dermott, you know, like you got another pick. He was never going to be, at best, he was going to be a number four defenseman. Travis Konecny, in terms of what he is, and I'm not talking last year, that type of player, you got to be careful about saying that two picks are better than one. You better be really careful with that.
Yeah, I agree. I think those days are done for Montreal personally, but
yeah.
Well, one last question on my side. You mentioned Jeff Gorton. He's he hired Nick Bobrov, who used to be director of European scouting for the New York Rangers. They worked together there. They worked together also back in the day with the Boston Bruins. Nick Bobrov being behind the selection of David Krejci back in 2002, I think. Yeah. So those two guys have a history together. So to which extent that familiarity plays an important role? I mean, is it that, because there's, on the one hand, you can look at guys saying, well, they're hiring their friends, or it's always the same circle, the same network, et cetera, et cetera. But there must be a payoff in the level of understanding of the game and agreement on what hockey guys value in prospects. So what do you make of an executive who brings a head scout in his third organization like that, like Bobrov coming to Montreal?
So, you know, the point you make, I mean, familiarity, trying to understand what somebody brings, you know, you're going to have a greater confidence when you have a familiarity with that person, right? And so we look at the connections and however it's framed. But the benefit that Jeff has, and I think this can be a significant benefit to Kent Hughes and the scouting staff, is Jeff's had the benefit of hearing Nick talk. Not just, we can look at the players that have been drafted and say, well, geez, he drafted this player, David Krejci. He drafted this player here. He was part of this, right? And make those connections. But Jeff has heard him talk about a lot of players. He's heard him talk about players they didn't draft. He's heard him make the case for one player over another player. And going through that process of, you know, that Nick would have gone through and saying, hey, you know what? I really think this player would be a good pick for us, or I don't think this player would be. And you formulate your list and then you come up with your list. Jeff has that benefit of having heard that many, many times, you know, and I think that becomes critical for your process of drafting and forming your list, and not just critical, you know, in the whole process, but certainly for Kent, who's never been through it. And, you know, Marty Lapointe, who's been part of this and now in a different way as part of it, like just to hear somebody go, yeah, I was there. I remember this. I'll share a quick story with you. And when I was in Dallas, Alfie Dahlin, who's just an unbelievable guy, we were looking for a scout in Sweden. So he mentioned a guy, and we talked to a number of them. We ended up hiring a guy by the name of Hasse Edlund. Now, we played in Frölunda, and we went out. He was just wonderful. I mean, he was everything we were looking for. So in the first draft that he came to, so we knew him. We spent time with him. But he kept telling us about a player. He says, I really think this player could be really good. I think this player. And we kept listening. And we're not talking in the first round. We're not talking in the second round. We weren't even talking about the third round. And he kept saying, I really think this. But we didn't have the same level of confidence And we didn't listen. The player was Daniel Alfredson. Oh. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Ooh, right?
Yeah.
So I give you the background about familiarity, and I give you the background of unfamiliarity, right?
Yeah.
Where it can benefit and where the part of it, like, you know, if you believe in people and it takes time to really believe in them, but you got to go in there and listen to the open. When you work in a group and a scouting staff, everybody wants to be right. We go back to the wanting to be right and not wanting to be wrong, and building that trust amongst your group and going, hey, you know, that's a really good point. We need to listen. And this point is a good point to consider that. And you know what, that person brought up a good point. And I frame that with Nick and Jeff, but also just because you don't have familiarity, if you value the people and you value their, and they're making a case, you best listen, and you listen hard.
But I think it's a good point in this that you make, in the sense that I think we did it just recently. Well, you can go back and look at the players that a team drafted, and be like, Elias Anderson, that didn't work out, you know, and they had to trade him. Kravtsov is kind of, you know, but you know, you can still name the guy who suggested that you draft Daniel Alfredson. Like, all these years later, you have that in your mind, you know. So I mean, I think that's an important point that you raise, that that people don't realize, is that, you know, Nick Bobrov probably has cases like that where Jeff Gorton's like, he was right there. I should have listened to him or whatever. So there's more to it than just going on HockeyDB and looking at all the draft lists and what have you. There's a lot more information there.
There's probably a debate of process versus results, just like on the ice with players, you know, when it comes to scouts. So
well said. And it is, it's teamwork of a different kind. It really is, Mark Antoine. That's a great point.
Right. Well, geez. Well, thank you so much, Craig. This was amazing. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing you in Montreal.
Yeah.
For the
draft. Looking forward to seeing you all too.
Absolutely. Have fun at the Memorial Cup, which I know you're heading to, and that everyone should tune into. Despite the Stanley Cup final going on, you should be watching the Memorial Cup as well, because for Canadians fans, you'll see Keegan Gooley, obviously, and Yan Mishak on the Hamilton Bulldogs. So there's two Canadians prospects, and you can watch Craig on TV on top of that.
Wow. And don't forget about Arbor Jacki. Like, no. You know what? I watched Arbor play, right? Like, you know, and like, I tell you what, just getting up front and up close with him, like he's put himself right. Like, he's got a real chance. Free agent. Yeah. Never drafted in the Ontario Hockey League, never drafted in the NHL. I'll tell you what, impressive to say the least.
Kent Hughes, when he was mentioning a few of the defensemen that you could see in Montreal next year, just listed off names kind of randomly. And the last one he mentioned was Arbor Jekka. And it's kind of like, we were like, really? Okay.
He didn't mention Matthias Norlander, but he mentioned Jekka.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Back to your point. I'll finish with this, Mark Antoine and Arpon. And thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to join you guys. I said it at the outset. I mean, you guys are so terrific in what you do. So to be part of it, I feel really honored that you asked me. But difference maker, Mark Antoine, somebody that wants to make a difference in the game. Even during the OHL final, I kept talking about developmental aspects. You know what? He's a thoroughbred, and you want to let him run. He'll learn certain situations that less is more, but you want somebody that plays the way Arbor plays. And I'll tell you what, so impressed, and difference maker. That's what you're looking for. Those guys that can make a difference in your lineup. You know, you can look at all kinds of players that have found their way to the NHL and been really good players that weren't drafted or weren't drafted high. I think Montreal with Arbor Jacki has a guy that has real significant potential.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Craig. Thanks a lot for being with us today. Really appreciate it. And as to everybody, I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Athletic Support. We'll be back next week in French, avec le Super Athletic. Thank you, everybody. Have a good week. Bye-bye.